First, though, we're going to begin this hour with the big news in Seattle. A city council member and some mayoral candidates are calling on Seattle's mayor to resign. The Seattle Times reported over the weekend that a child welfare investigator in Oregon concluded in the 1980s that Ed Murray sexually abused his foster son. The county prosecutor did not file a criminal charge, and Mayor Murray denies that and other allegations of sexual abuse. He is not running for re-election. I've been interviewing the leading candidates to replace Ed Murray, and today I'm with candidate, educator, attorney, artist, activist, boxer, Nikita Oliver. Good to see you again. Welcome back.
Good to see you as well. Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your campaign for mayor, why are you calling on the current mayor to resign when he denies the allegations and hasn't been through the courts?
You know, the findings in Oregon are actually an administrative law finding. And so it's important to recognize that there is a finding of at least a recognized type of due process. And I think it really comes down to accountability, but also the constant public rehashing of sexual abuse and violence that is incredibly re-traumatizing for a lot of people. I think even more so, it really is about accountability. It's about him acknowledging that at least the implications of the continued story, what that has upon the city and what it means for him to continue to have that on his plate as he's effectively leading our city. But honestly, my campaign has no interest in politicizing tragedy. And part of why we're answering the question is because media is asking, but also because it is important for our elected officials to be willing to speak up when something is out of sorts, instead of just simply protecting each other and being willing to admit when something seems like it might be wrong. And we need to really pursue accountability and protection, especially for those communities that most need access to services as they're dealing with sexual trauma and abuse and violence.
Okay, so just so listeners are clear, you mentioned the idea of this whole conversation being re-traumatizing for some people, a distraction. Are you assuming that Murray's consistent denials are a lie, or are you saying it's just a problem regardless of that judgment?
I'm not saying they're a lie. What I will say is there's been absolutely no acknowledgement of victims, no victims, not the ones who have alleged, but also of the many victims that actually live within our city. And that there's really what we should be doing is this should draw our attention as a city towards providing more services. And he's not even entered the conversation from that perspective. How do we see this as the bigger substantive issue that it is, and acknowledge that this should draw us towards looking at systems of accountability, but also looking at what services are we providing for community members that are struggling with the trauma of sexual violence and abuse?
Okay, final question on this subject. Councilmember Gonzalez actually gave Murray a deadline to resign, or else the city council should convene its own committee to study a transition in leadership, which sounds to me like impeachment. I just want to know, do you think Murray should be forced out of office?
I think that the city council should do its own investigation as a way of being a part of the checks and balances of our city, of ensuring that all of our leaders are being held to a particular standard of accountability, but more importantly, transparency. And I think the council sits in the position to provide that. I'm not going to comment on the deadline, but I do think it's important that given that these allegations have remained consistent and they are having an impact on the city, that the council do some sort of investigation of its own.
Okay. Now, on the subject of your campaign for mayor, which is why you're here, you were in a candidate's debate last night, which we aired live on KUOW. And during the debate, David tweeted on KUOW's Twitter page, David says, "I agree with many of their positions, but I have no sense of how will they prioritize when they can't accomplish them all. What is your top priority?"
Yeah, and I think that's an incredibly important question. Our top priorities are looking at the affordability crisis and the state of emergency around homelessness, and seeing how that is. Those two things are interconnected with each other, but they're also interconnected with development and transportation, as well as how do we help families become economically viable, both through having access to housing, community land trusts, what property allows families to become economically viable, but also access to jobs. I think the reality is we keep treating the issue of affordability as if it's siloed, as if it's separate from other issues in our city, and it's just simply not. So as we prioritize around the state of emergency of homelessness and the affordability crisis, I think it's important that we look at the root causes of poverty and understand that, really a part of our long-term strategy is helping families overcome those root causes. And then we'll see less families that are moved into homelessness.
So you're saying it's not so much a bunch of priorities as it is these are interconnected.
Absolutely.
So then I'm talking with Nikita Oliver. How would Seattle be different if you were mayor as opposed to Ed Murray? What's that vision?
You know, the vision is about how do we pull from the margins and lift from the bottom of our city so that the whole of our city can be healthier. There are a lot of people that are being displaced, that are being pushed out, who for a myriad of reasons don't have access to jobs and opportunity and housing the way that they should. And I believe that education and housing are a human right. And it is really upon our leaders of the city to be providing a vision for what that looks like so we can have a healthier city, but also providing goals, metrics, looking at our budget and prioritizing our $5.6 billion budget towards achieving a healthier city. And I believe the way that we do that is by supporting the people at the margins and the people at the bottom. And when we pull and we lift, the whole of our city does better.
How do you think that $5.6 billion budget is being misspent now, if it is?
So we have a variety of priorities that I just do not think meet the goals of addressing the affordability crisis and the state of emergency around homelessness. One example, when we look at how we spend our funds, is looking at our criminal legal system. Seattle Municipal Court, in a lot of ways, criminalizes poverty when we look at low-level misdemeanors. One that we've heard in the community is that when people get on the light rail and they're not able to pay, you may get stopped by fair enforcement and get a ticket. So you go from paying $5 to ride to getting a ticket for $124. Now, if you couldn't pay the initial fee to get on, you certainly cannot pay the ticket. If you do that multiple times, eventually that can turn into a theft three that our court is then prosecuting people for being poor.
That well, what else could we do with
a waste
with
of light fiscal resources?
Okay. What else would we do about light rail free riders?
Yeah. So one of the things that we're wanting to do is make sure that young people under the age of 18 all receive a free ORCA card, and to ensure that also our elders and our seniors have access to those more amenities when it comes to public transportation, as a way of doing two things. One, not criminalizing poverty and recognizing that having access to public transportation, especially for our young people, is incredibly important. But two, building a culture of using public transportation within our younger generation so that as they get older and they have children, that becomes more likely. This is important for our city on an environmental level. This is important for our city as we further build out our transportation infrastructure and as we build affordable housing around that infrastructure to encourage the use of public transportation. So it's a multifaceted approach. It all goes back to our vision of not seeing any problem within our city as siloed, but understanding they're actually all incredibly interconnected. So we need solutions that are about systems integration, about making all of these systems lead towards a single vision of a healthier city.
Talking with Nikita Oliver, one of the leading candidates for the position of mayor of the city of Seattle. A listener named Clark said on Facebook, building more apartments is not the answer to affordable housing. It isn't a supply issue. Even when these new complexes open, they are still priced through the roof. Is affordable housing in Seattle, is it an issue of supply?
It is partly an issue of supply and partly an issue of market. One of the problems that I foresee in terms of how we've been addressing the affordability crisis is we have been relying upon the private market as the answer to that. That's part of the reason why with MHA, which is one of the 65 recommendations in HALA, asking for 2 to 11% affordable housing. One, it's not enough, but two,
it's asking developers to
invest in affordable housing. It's just simply not enough in terms of percentage, but it's also not enough in terms of our market. So we really need a multifaceted strategy that also looks at building public housing strategically. We can't just build it anywhere. We need to build it around our infill stations that we'll be having with the light rail and around places where we know transportation is robust. But the third thing is we need market intervention strategies, because I think this listener is correct. Our market consistently goes up and our definition of affordable doesn't adjust as that market goes up. As we say, the average median income each year it increases, so then 30 to 60% increases, but those income gains are not shared across populations. So when I speak about market intervention, I'm thinking about speculators. We have a huge speculation market that is driving the cost of housing up, and as a result, I think we need a speculator tax as a way of of decreasing that behavior, but also a way to fund public housing by actually deterring the behavior, but also then saying, you know, speculators are going to be an inevitability in our market, so they might as well be contributing to our affordable housing plan.
Speculators meaning people who don't live in the property they're buying.
Yes.
Yeah. You mentioned public housing. Also during last night's mayoral debate, a different David tweeted, I support affordable housing, but all I hear about is public housing. How will you pay for it while middle class is priced out?
I believe that our public housing infrastructure also has to serve our middle class, our working class families. And public housing cannot just be about building public housing buildings and units. It's also got to be about community land trust. I think the city has to get in the business of buying land and then allowing families, inviting them to have homes on those pieces of land as a way of building their economic viability. Affordability is not just about having an affordable place to live. It's also about having the ability to make yourself economically sustainable, both by owning property, but also having access to high earner jobs. And so we need to, alongside building housing and building housing opportunities, we need to be building pipelines into jobs. And we have a robust industry, a tech industry. We have a maritime industry. We need to be finding ways to ensure that our young people who live here now have access to those jobs when they graduate from high school, when they finish college, as a way of ensuring the economic viability of our middle class and our low-income families.
So speculator tax, ask more of developers, require more of developers. Who else pays more if Seattle's new income tax doesn't hold up in the courts?
You know, we have to be committed to pursuing a transformation of our incredibly regressive tax structure. With property taxes and sales taxes, we are saying that those who earn less actually have to pay more. I believe that we're going to, in the next few years, be able to get this progressive income tax through. One, based on the heart of Seattle, I think a lot of our high earners want to invest more. And honestly, the legislation actually asks for a very limited amount on high earners above $250,000. The second thing is we're one of seven states that have this sort of upside down tax structure. So there is a lot of analogous law in other states that I think will be very moving for the courts, because the case that we're fighting is from the 1930s. And so I think that we have a high likelihood of it moving forward. If it doesn't, we do need to look at other means of taxation to begin to bring down these incredibly regressive taxes. I think when we think about building out our city, impact fees are going to be incredibly important. I think we can ask more of our corporations with a corporate head tax. And then we need to look at our small businesses. How do we make these taxes that we put in place that impact business progressive as well, to ensure that our small businesses don't take hard hits the same way that our low-income families, we don't want them to take hard hits.
Nikita Oliver, educator, attorney, artist, activist, and running for mayor of Seattle. You have said that Seattle's historically black central district needs to be a centralized space where young people of color can find support from people who look like them and who understand their place in society. Seattle neighborhoods have always turned over and changed. Rainier Valley used to be Italian. Why try to freeze one neighborhood's racial identity in time?
I think that when I talk about the Central District, and to be honest, not too many black folks live in the Central District anymore,
right,
is that in a lot of ways it's become a space where we can see the cultural capital that black folks have contributed to the city, and yet we don't get access to it. I don't know if we can turn that around. But what I do know is when we look at areas like the Chinatown International District, we do not have to make the same mistakes that we've made in the Central District or that we seem like we're beginning to make in the Rainier Beach area. What we can do is put in place anti-displacement strategies by investing in affordable commercial spaces for local businesses, by investing in community land trust that we put in the hands of trusted nonprofits that are already existing in the Central area, by relying upon the community voice to direct us and what it looks like for that area to be developed. It's important not just about the cultural identity of young people being able to continue to have access to that, but it is also about being willing to preserve the cultural identities that have made our city economically viable. People want to be in Seattle because of the things that Native peoples, that Black peoples, that the API community have contributed here, and we build relics to it all over the city. We need to make sure that the cultures and communities that have contributed to that still have access to that in those spaces.
Speaking, you're broadening it from racial identity and values to cultural values. Mm-hmm. On the subject of race, you helped Macklemore write the song White Privilege 2?
I did help in the writing and development of that.
What did you contribute?
So I met Ben right after
Ben Haggerty, Macklemore.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right after the non-indictment of Darren Wilson, we were involved in a number of demonstrations, and he had contacted me through Hollis Wong, where saying that he wanted to find ways to connect in particular with Black organizers so that he could act accountably as a white ally. And so we first started just by having a lot of long conversations about what is white privilege? How do you leverage it as a way of creating systems transformation and change? What does an ally really look like? What does an accomplice look like as we're trying to make big transformation through movements like Black Lives Matter when we think about things like liberation? And so we started doing some projects together, and he came to me one day and said, hey, will you meet me at a coffee shop? And we actually ended up sitting in his Cadillac, and he played a track for me and rapped for me the first few verses he had originally written. And I said, a few of those verses are a little bit off. I don't know if you want to put that out into the world yet. And so literally for about 14 months, we would meet once a month for a few hours.
What did he rap that didn't make it into the song?
I cannot say.
Okay.
But it really was a process of Ben and really the whole team that contributed to it, because there were other artists on board, finding ways to communicate the ways in which white folks can be a part of Black Lives Matter in a way that's accountable, but also leverages white privilege as a way to talk about what we were seeing when it comes to police brutality and police accountability.
Well, what did you think of some of the blowback he got for patting himself awfully hard on the back?
You know, I, as someone who's now found myself in the media a lot, I recognize that sometimes the stories that get told are not entirely accurate. And I think Ben tried very hard to work very closely with especially Black organizers and Black artists, so that it wasn't a pat on the back. I think no matter how, what direction he went, if he didn't say anything, people were going to call him out for saying something. People were going to call him out. And so I think what he did was he set an example of taking a bold step and then taking the blowback, accepting that that is a part of accountability. It's a part of transparency. It's also a part of us growing and transforming as we try to transform the world around us.
So he took some punches.
He did.
Speaking of which, I opened this conversation saying you're an educator, attorney, artist, activist, candidate, boxer. What'd you learn from boxing? Who's your favorite boxer?
Who's my favorite boxer? I mean, I think that's easy. Muhammad Ali. I love boxing at our Caro Boxing over on 12th and Jefferson. And what I love most about it is you learn about yourself. You might think you get into the ring and you're fighting your opponent, but reality is your biggest enemy in the ring will always be you. And so over the past few years of training, what I've really learned to do is to always turn any question I have or any fear I have or any critique I have back on myself first as a way of grounding myself and being a better person. And so there's something about taking a punch that makes you have to think about yourself. But also, if you're going to punch someone, you had better be willing to take one. And so, especially as I think about the mayor's race and the many times I get asked for comment, I think twice. And it's really based upon my practice as a boxer of understanding that strategy and your willingness to take a hit all ultimately will determine how you do in the ring. But even more than that is your discipline, your commitment outside of the ring to be constantly training. All fights are really won outside the ring before you ever step in there.
Not just a boxer, but an activist, a poet, an attorney, an educator, and one of the leading candidates to be the mayor of the booming city of Seattle. Nikita Oliver, thanks for this time together.
Yeah, thank you for having me.